Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Curtain. I'm Paul Listick. I'm going to be spending some time with you talking about politics, as we often do. And then a little later in the podcast, we'll be talking to the cast of Tap Dogs. It is a global dance sensation that is coming to the Nederlander Theater here in Chicago, part of the Broadway in Chicago series. It sounds like it's going to be very cool. So we'll be talking to a couple of the stars in that. But first, I want to explore what's been going on in the world of politics with a frequent friend, guest. Well, he's a frequent guest. He is a friend. And that is Richard Gordon. He's an attorney. He's a Democratic strategist. He has the perspective of many campaigns behind him. And we're going to take a look at what has been going on lately. Richard, welcome back. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Greetings from Washington, where I am today.
Oh, very good. I assume you're at the White House for meetings.
No, I wasn't invited, unfortunately. Well, fortunately.
Okay. Okay. So lots going on today, as always, but I did, or this week, I should say. But I do want to start with the topic of immigration, because what got reported mm-hmm. this week, which the White House confirmed and denied and everything else, is this notion that to handle immigration, it looks like what the president wanted to do was take these folks at the border and just bus them on over to some sanctuary cities where they could live happily ever after. Now, you know, my first expectation was to see a total denial of that. Actually, the White House admitted, yes, we thought about it. It was very brief, and we found out it was quite illegal to do that, not happening. And then, of course, moments later, the president tweets, no, this may be what we do. What's your reaction to it?
Total shock and outrage. You would think by 2.5 years into this administration, I would cease to be shocked by anything that goes on. But this one is horrible. To use an issue, to use people's lives, families, children, as political pawns, it's just horrible. What the president wanted to do, and says he still wants to do as of just a little while ago, is to put these people in his adversaries' districts in order to cause them political problems. And to use these people in that way is just awful. As I said, you would think by now we would all get used to these type of things. I think he understands that it is illegal for him to do it, but he still says these things because I think he wants to create the anger and the outrage out there and to cause people like Nancy Pelosi and others political pain.
So my response to this is, as I mulled it over, was, and it's really, really kind of emerges from what you've just said, the president's key concern is keep the base, inflame the base, keep them going. From that perspective only, forget about the fact that this involves humans and everything else you said, which I acknowledge, I think it's brilliant on the part of the president. Because if this doesn't get his 40%, I mean, I believe every one of them would say, darn right, you want him into the country? Put them in the sanctuary cities where we can't get, let them kill everybody. I really think this will absolutely be met with great favor by those who support him in his world of immigration and control.
Oh, I completely agree with you. I was actually thinking about right and wrong and moral and immoral.
Yeah, we'll put that out of your mind.
Yeah, let's just forget that. But in this instance, I think you're right. I think the base will love this. Why not ship these people to San Francisco and to New York and to other places? If they're violent, if they're drug dealers, if they're all these horrible things that President Trump tells us they are, and they cause trouble, well, then it's their problem.
So, Richard, can I stop you? I want to ask you right there, because if, in fact, that is the reaction of the base, and obviously we both agree that it is or will be, then if you are the mayor of San Francisco, if you're the governor of California, or, you know, that seems to be the place that'll get the brunt of it. You know, so far the reaction of some, you know, town mayors that I've seen on the air has been what you said in the first place. It's inhumane. It's not how you treat people. That is not responsive to a base who says you're the ones who believe in open borders, even though they don't. This is what you should. What is a better response? If you were consulting with some of these mayors or the governor of California, do you have something that actually would appeal to the base to have them say, okay, I get it. Maybe that gives me pause. Or is there really no good answer to them?
To President Trump's base?
Yes, correct.
I don't think there is an answer to them. I think the only answer would be to call their bluff, to say that our borders are open, that we welcome immigrants, that the immigrants in a lot of these cities have done so many wonderful things and helped the economy and make them bigger and better and stronger cities. I don't think there's anything you could say to Trump's base that would make them feel better about this, except bring it on. And I think that's what they want. They want a fight. They want an argument. They want to relive all the horrible things that have gone on in places like Charlottesville and other places. I think that's what they want. And I just don't think there's any way you are ever going to make them feel better about these things.
In that case, we'll see how it proceeds.
Which is sad. It's a sad comment. It's not the comment I would like to make. I'd like to make a comment that says, you know, let's work together on this. Let's figure out a way to handle these people as humanely as possible. Let's listen to their concerns. Let's find, let's make sure they have health care. Let's make sure their children get education, et cetera. I mean, those are the type of answers I would like to give. But to be honest with you, Paul, I just don't see how, if you did those things, the base would go his base would go crazy anyway.
I'm sure that's right. Let me talk about a couple of appointments. Obviously, to the federal board of governors, if you're going to make appointments, you certainly want Herman Cain and Stephen Moore to be your guys. Herman Cain looks like we can fairly quickly dismiss that, right? Because if people don't remember him, he's the guy that ran for president in 2012, I think it was, saying 999 should be the tax rakes across the board. It looks like there's already four Republicans who said that's not happening. But it looks like the no votes are because Herman Cain has had some sexual misconduct allegations against him, not because he's completely incompetent to sit on the board.
Well, a couple things. One, you have to remember he pulled out of the presidential race because five women, I believe, accused him of sexual misconduct, and within a month he was out of the campaign.
If he ran today, nobody would care.
To me, that should be a complete non-starter. Like, how could one even suggest something like that? But, you know, he did serve on the regional board in Kansas City. He was the president of the board for a number of years. So, and he has run major corporations, Godfather Pizza, et cetera. But, look, the mere fact that he's had these allegations out there, I don't think they've ever been proven or unproven. It just makes it unpalatable. I mean, it's ridiculous. He can't serve. And four Republican senators just said absolutely not. They won't vote for him. And that basically, I think, will kill his nomination.
So actually, you acknowledge and agree that it looks like it is the sexual allegations that come into play. It's really not about his competence to sit on the board.
Yes, I do. I don't even think people are getting that far. Look, Mitch McConnell's in a tough position. Donald Trump keeps sending him, terrible people that he's asking McConnell to get through the Senate. And McConnell is trying to get these people through, whether they're judicial appointments or Federal Reserve Board or whatever. And McConnell's job is to get them through. And they're horrible. And he's putting his members, he's putting the senators in a terrible position. How do you vote for someone who has all these allegations against them and then go back home and run for re-election? So McConnell doesn't want to see this happen either.
With regard to Stephen Moore, that's an interesting one because, first of all, he's a CNN commentator. If people aren't connecting to the name, I think you'd know his face if you saw him. He's written a book called Trumponomics. I actually may be interviewing him next week. But here's the thing. Yes, the Fed board's supposed to be independent. But I've seen some interviews he's done over this. And, you know, his view of the world is, look, the economy is doing great. President Trump's policies are great. What is your problem with me sitting on the Fed? A lot of the things we've suggested are happening and they're helping. So what is the problem with Stephen Moore?
Look, I think it's in your question. I think the answer to this is that you're supposed to be independent. You're supposed to be a check on the system and an ability to look at the system and say, well, what needs to be done? Do we need to raise the rate? Do we not need to raise the rate? This isn't should not be a political calculus. This should not be about Donald Trump's reelection. I think Trump really regrets putting the chairman on because he feels that has hurt the economy, and he feels he should have control of that. He's looking for allies. He's putting on people who are basically friends of his, who are allies of his, who will do exactly what he wants to do. That is not what the job of the Federal Reserve is at all. And that's why he doesn't deserve to be on. He doesn't have any other reason to be on except that he's a friend of Trump's and that he agrees with him.
Speaking of allies, curious to get your reaction to the testimony of Attorney General William Barr before the House and Senate committees. I think when he was first appointed, you and I probably talked on Politics Tonight and probably said, you know, we had hopes that this is somebody who would come in and understand the gravitas of the role of the Department of Justice. He'd been there before. And I really, you know, I thought it may have been one of those picks where the president made it and then realized, wait a minute, looks like this guy's legit. Is this guy legit?
I have a lot of respect for him. He's one of these people who's been a long time, who I think is a very reasonable and rational person. I have been very disappointed, totally shocked by his behavior. I actually was one of those people who thought, you know, he would be the adult in the room who would sort of set the table right. And I haven't seen that at all. His testimony was pretty shocking, you know, as far as how he's going to redact the documents, when they're going to get the documents, who's going to get to see it, et cetera. I've been really very disappointed in his performance as Attorney General, because I think that is another role, ironically, that has to almost be above the fray. You know, it has to be someone who has the ability to just say, well, this is the law, this is the right thing. And I just don't see that in what in his performance. And his performance the other day, his testimony was very disappointing. These documents need to come out. The American people need to understand what is going on. You have a president who's running around the country saying, "Look, I'm totally exonerated. There's nothing about me in this," and that's just not true. That's not true. And the public needs to understand that.
If he does his color coding, you know, removals from the document, as he said he is. I mean, there's some people who believe we're going to see very little of this. I don't know. We'll see what we see. But my question is, do you think ultimately, knowing what you do about government, when Congress takes him to court saying, look, maybe the public can see that redacted version, we need it all because we have a job to do. We got to decide whether to impeach this president. You won't do it. So the only way we get to do this is with a Mueller report. Do they ultimately win or do they lose when a Supreme Court that leans towards the president says, sorry, your power doesn't go that far?
Yeah, I think they ultimately lose, and I just don't see how this happens in a timely fashion either. You know, the Iowa caucuses are, 300 days away or something like that. You know, we are about to be thrust into a re-election campaign. I just don't see how it happens in time, and I think, look, I have a lot of respect for the Supreme Court. I think they usually do the right thing. In the last couple of years, that hasn't really been the case. I would like to believe that they would look at this objectively, like they did, for example, the Nixon tape hearing back when, and would be objective. I don't have that faith and confidence. I also don't believe in the timeliness of this, which means, you know, you can't string this out for the next couple of years and then have the Supreme Court take the case.
Bill Barr could have, like Ken Starr, gone to the court and said, yes, let's release the grand jury testimony and all of that. That's what Ken Starr did. Bill Barr says, I'm not going to do that. My question is, do you think, again, Bill Barr's just being an institutionalist, doing what he believes to be the right thing, or is everybody, and I'll throw the tax return demand in here as well, is basically everybody under orders to just run out the clock, get us through November of 2020, let's get reelected, and then let's see what happens?
Yeah, it's an interesting double standard we have going on here, because Starr wanted to release a report that was embarrassing to the president of the United States, right? It was salacious. There was a lot of stuff in there that was just meant to embarrass Bill Clinton. Barr is trying to protect the president by keeping out a lot of things in there, which I assume are criminal, but are just things that the American people would find awful. On the tax returns, which is a very similar argument, Congress, for the last, I think, 80 years, has had the ability to get the president's tax returns. They don't release it to the public, but someone objective, has to look at the president's tax returns to find out if there's something that we need to know about, if something is going on that the president of the United States is doing that is improper. Congress gets all types of information and that we don't know about, as we shouldn't, all types of classified intelligence, et cetera, that we don't need to know about. I have complete confidence that if the tax returns were given over to the Congress in camera, as we say, for them to look at, only them, if there's something there, they will come forward. If there's not, well, they should tell us that too. The president is fighting so hard not to have his tax returns released. Every other president's tax returns have been looked at, including Nixon while he was being under audit. It makes no sense that this president won't turn over his tax returns. Someone needs to look at them. Someone objective who's not just working for him needs to look at them and find out what the heck is in there.
Knowing the laws, you know it. Knowing what's right, what's wrong. If we're at the roulette table in Vegas and your options are, who wins this one? The president gets through the election with nothing happening, or things come out? What do you think the net result is?
I don't mean to be a pessimist here. The right thing to do would be for them to come out. What will happen, I believe, is they will not come out. And this will be a stall for another year and a half. Possibly they come out at some point, but again, not in a timely fashion that's going to affect the election. I think in basketball we used to call it the four corners. I think that's what this president's trying to do. He's just trying to drag everything out to make sure that there's nothing embarrassing about him that comes out before the election.
Yeah, I think that's right. Final topic before I let you go, which is Pete Buttigieg, sure. Mayor from South Bend, Indiana, impressing a lot of people, rising to number three in a lot of different polls. But here's my question. I mean, he's being very thoughtful and pensive and whatever about all the... Ooh, pensive, that was a good word based on what I'm going to ask you.
Yeah.
About, you know, being a gay man and basically saying, you know, Mr. Pence, Vice President, if you have a problem with my sexual orientation, you don't have the problem with me, take it up with my creator. I mean, this is a religious man who's speaking. At the same time, you have to ask whether this country is able to even consider electing a gay man as president. Does Pete Buttigieg change the landscape, or is he a blip in time right now?
Well, I know Pete very well. I've known him for many years. He's a wonderful person. I think his biggest problem is that he's 37, not that he's gay. You know, people's views on sexual orientation have changed dramatically over the last number of years, and I think that's obviously a wonderful thing. I have always been perplexed by the vice president's views on these issues, and I agree with the mayor in that it is hard to be a religious person and claim to love everyone and then to be someone who is so critical of people who are different than you. I've never understood that. I admire what the mayor said about the vice president's views on this, because to me they're completely inconsistent with a truly religious person. As far as the mayor's viability, look, he's raising a lot of money, and I was with him about a month or two ago where he gave a speech, and a number of the other contenders gave speeches, and he was head and shoulders the best. This isn't an endorsement. This is just an analytical view.
Sure.
He is not afraid to say what he thinks. He's not afraid to come out with proposals that he thinks are more common sense. He doesn't run to all of these, mainstay Democratic issues. I have to say this because this is what the base wants to hear me say, which probably will not be successful. I think we're looking at a period in time where he has a natural base that could keep him afloat for a very, very, very long time. And will he win the nomination? Well, I would think the odds are pretty slim. But I think he's going to be around for a while in this contest where a lot of other people who don't have a natural base will fall away. Are the American people willing to elect a gay man? Well, 12 years ago, I think a lot of people didn't think they'd elect a black. And 50-some-odd years ago, they didn't think they'd elect a Catholic. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we're, you know, constantly creating new territory and that we're opening our minds more and are more accepting. At least that's the hopeful person in me. And I think Pete represents that in a lot of ways.
It must be very interesting to see social issues like sexual orientation tied to Pete Buttigieg, or, you know, the alleged conduct of Vice President Joe Biden if he enters the race, which he's not there yet. You know, it's just amazing that it looks like the Democrats are facing having to defend themselves on social issues in this way, when they're up against so many social questions on the other end that just, I don't know, the focus is really...
It's really a double standard. It's very interesting that, you know, the Democrats are constantly having to fight these issues. And let's be honest about this. A lot of them are self-inflicted or inflicted because other candidates and people tied to other candidates are putting this into the campaign, you know, intentionally. I think the President Obama said, you know, we're a circular, you know, shooting squad, firing squad. And I think that's really true. We're going out of our way to destroy each other. And that's just not the way to be. One of these people needs to be the nominee and needs the respect and the ability to go forward. And by constantly fighting with each other, it's not going to help the cause.
I'm with you. Attorney, political strategist Richard Gordon, as always, thanks for your insights. It's always valuable. I've made a list of those things you predicted. We'll revisit them in the future to see how it goes. And for now, thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure being on. Thank you very much.
All right. Appreciate it.
Talk to you soon.
Yeah, if you're enjoying that beat, you can enjoy that beat for quite a lot longer. But you got to go see Tap Dogs playing at the Nederlander Theater. It's part of Broadway in Chicago's series this year. It's playing there from April 16th to 21st. This is a really cool show. I had some thoughts about what it might be, but we're going to find out exactly what it is, because it is not just a tap dance show. Not that that wouldn't be bad. I like tap. But there's just a lot of other stuff going on here. Part dance, part theater, part rock concert, man. So much going on. We got two of the stars with us here to talk about the show coming up, so I want you to get ready. Now, this comes out of Australia. That's where it's based. So, of course, I was not surprised to see that one of the stars, Anthony Russo, AJ, you are from St. Louis, Australia, and also joining me, Justin Miles, who comes from Maryland, Australia. You see, guys, I know you're not really from Australia, but
I have a Maryland, Australia.
I just, you know what? We're together 2 seconds, and I'm giving it away. So, AJ, let me start with you. Obviously, the show is based in Australia, but is this an all-American cast?
This particular company is actually split 4 and 4. We've got 4 guys from Australia and 4 guys from the United States on this one. So it's actually a really, really nice blend.
I love it. Justin, so as I said, it's hard for me to describe this because it's more than just a tap show. It is called Tap Dogs. I actually mentioned this to one friend who thought there were going to be dogs involved, so I had to set him straight. But Justin, tell me what it is we're in for when we come and see y'all perform.
Well, you had a pretty good introduction there. It is part theater, part rock concert, and of course, there's tap dancing involved. We use different surfaces on a construction site that we actually built from the ground up. We have steel ladders, scaffolding. We use different types of woods that we tap dance on, because the set we like to think is like the 7th member of our cast. So we're going to work. We have grinders. There's water involved. We just make music out of all types of different surfaces with our feet.
And is there plot to this? Is it moving through something, or we're just getting different scenes and different kind of settings for them?
Well, there's no dialogue, there's no script, but it is a very character-driven show. You have 6 very distinct characters. The show is full of comedy. Justin is one of the funniest people I've ever seen on a stage in my career. But it's basically, it's 6 guys going to work, working hard, 85 minutes. There's no drama, there's no real plot, but however, the interactions between the characters. I play the role of the foreman, and Dean Perry, the creator of the show, his son, Reed Perry, is playing the kid in the show. And there's a routine there where we have like a sort of mentorship routine where I'm kind of showing him the ropes, and throughout the course of the show, we kind of keep him in line and make sure he knows where to go and when.
Oh, I love it. So now, this show's been around for over 20 years itself. So was Dean Perry ever in it and kind of turned it over to his son, AJ, or this is kind of a first with the son being in it?
Dean Perry was the original foreman in the show.
Ah, okay.
And whenever I first got hired for Tap Dogs back in 2001, Dean Perry's brother, Sheldon, was playing the foreman. And now here we are about 17, 18 years later, in my run with Tap Dogs, and I'm playing the foreman, and now young Reed Perry is playing the kid. So it's an incredibly full circle experience for me on this one.
Look forward to seeing that. Hey, Justin, you got a great compliment there in terms of your talent from AJ, and that's coming from a guy who crashed an audition once for Cirque du Soleil, and his headshot was just apparently a little sketch that he put on a piece of paper. But hey, AJ, you got the gig, so good for you.
Landed it.
But anyway, yeah, you landed that one. So, Justin, with that compliment in tow, talk to me about your character's called Rat. Doesn't sound positive, yes, but I'm guessing it's kind of adorable.
It is. He's exactly what he's adorable. I love it. Yeah. He's kind of the rat. It's just his job is just to take the piss out of everybody. He's trying to get a rise out of the foreman. And he just gets his hand caught in a cookie jar a lot, kind of like the comic relief of the whole show. Everyone has distinct moments where they, like AJ said, where they have their characters pop. But I kind of just like to thread, the rat likes to just kind of thread his little journey throughout the whole show. And I got like a cap I wear on backwards and introduce like some really cool concepts into some of the routines.
And
cool. Anything I can do to make the boys laugh on stage is a good night.
Oh, so is there, well, that raises the question, Justin, is there a little improv to this where, in other words, if we see the guys laughing, it's just because you're doing something they're not expected, or is it something you do every night and they're just fake laughing?
It's
it's I hope they never fake laugh.
But no, I can speak on that. It's real.
It's real. Yeah. There's even last night when we were performing, I think I pulled some stuff out, and you could just like, I know when AJ, when his chin, like when his head drops down and then his chin hits his chest and he's just, all I see is the shoulders going, you know, I know that I got him pretty good. And it's good to say too, the rest of the boys laugh too. And I know if I can make them laugh, the audience is going to laugh off of it too. It's really good energy and competitive.
I love it.
Kinetic energy.
That's great. And you know what?
It's really fun.
And as somebody who will be in the audience with you guys opening night, I mean, I think it's really heartwarming for an audience when we see that you guys are really connected, that you guys are, and I'm guessing you guys are friends, right? I mean, you're on the road now. You're all over the place. You guys have to get along very well.
I mean, it's a small cast. You know, there's six guys on stage. We have two swings. So in total, there's eight of us, two drummers. I mean, cast and crew total, we're 17 people. So we've been on a world tour since August. And, you know, this show has always had a bit of like a brotherhood. You know, you get these guys that grew up tap dancing, which was, so, as far as the dance community, sometimes put on the bottom of the totem pole. So we're in like a niche of a niche almost. And we find ourselves doing this show, which is, I mean, to me, this is one of the toughest tap dance shows in the world. It's 85 minutes nonstop. We're not just tap dancing. We're building our own set. And if you accomplish something incredible with a group of people in any facet of your life, there's that bond that's created for life. You know, you hike Mount Everest with a group of people, you're never going to be able to share that experience with another group of folks ever again.
That's right. Hey, Justin, I know you run NBC's World of Dance, working with the Jam Project. How does something like doing the television thing come into play when you're to this experience, when you're traveling the country, same show every night, you're not in a competition?
Two different worlds there. And like you said, it was a very big competition with World of Dance. It was a great opportunity to dance in front of the celebrity judges. Two different kinds of things. I've been more commercialized, I think, with something like with that type of platform. And real quick, I mean, with that, you only got like 60 seconds to prove to the world, like, hey, here's what we do. It was a really good opportunity because with the tap dance, like he said, it's we're at the bottom of the totem pole when it comes to that style of dance. And it was really, really awesome to be able to honor that style on a platform like a national a TV show as such as World of Dance. But then when you got Tap Dogs, obviously this is a theater type show that's we travel the country like no different than like a rock star band for sure.
Sure.
And we just got off our tour buses a couple days ago, so.
And that's why you are like a rock star band. You're on a bus, traveling around.
Yeah.
By the way, I taught Derek Hough how to dance, just in case he ever never told you that.
Oh, nice. Ballroom.
Oh.
Ballroom dancing.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't tell him I said, I've interviewed him, but don't tell him I said that. No, I'm kidding. So, hey, AJ, so let me ask you, first of all, are you guys going to be staying in the U.S.? Do you become an international tour? Are you guys hired to just tour the country? What will be the future?
As far as the future for Tap Dogs,
yeah.
You know, the beauty of theater, we're not too certain when the show is going to go out again. That's kind of how it's been with me with Tap Dogs since I was a teenager. You know, you go out for a 5-month contract, you tour, you know, North America, I've toured Australia, and when the contract comes to an end, sometimes you're not always certain where it's going to go next. There's a lot of interest in some other countries and cities, but at the moment we don't have anything confirmed. So we all kind of go back to either teaching, we create our own projects. Justin and I play music and write songs together. We all kind of have these other facets of our lives that we can kind of use to fill in the gaps when the tours aren't going out and rocking hard.
So AJ, so you and Justin collaborate. Is that did you guys meet during the show, or was there a history?
Yeah, we met doing Tap Dogs in Reno, 2002, I believe.
Oh, okay, and then just realized you guys can collaborate.
Yeah, he gave me a CD back then, and it was an album that he completely self-produced. He sang, he played the guitar, he played the bass, he played the drums, recorded it, mixed it all himself.
Very cool, Justin. Good job.
Yeah, multi-talented.
Yeah. So if I were to, Justin, if I were to, you know, when people are asking me about this, I have not seen it, so I'm looking forward to it, again, being there at opening, but I want to tell people, well, it's kind of like Stomp, and yet I'm feeling when I say that I'm probably not being fair to it, or I might even be totally wrong, so you guys can kind of tell me. Am I off base to tell somebody, think Stomp, and you'll get a sense of this, Justin?
To a point, yeah. We do kind of like create that atmosphere. They both have a very similar palette, if you will. But with Stomp, they're using different objects to make music, but with their hands, more drumming. With us, on the construction site before, we're tap dancing, of course, on different surfaces on this construction site as we're building it from the ground up. We're making that music with that palette, but the rock star feel of it. We got guys on stage, like he said, six distinctive characters wearing jeans and flannels and tank tops and just going to work. And we actually don't use a normal tap shoe in the show, because if we did, we'd break it. We'd break our feet, too. We use a Blundstone boot out of Australia, like a really heavy endurance duty boot that we tap up with leather sole and put taps on it. It's a heavy boot.
Yeah.
And you'll come in wondering, if you've never seen the show before. It's something we say all the time. It's not your average tap dance show. It's very modernized. There's no tux or top hats or canes and, you know,
you say that, because actually
I think aesthetically it does have a similar flavor as Stomp. These shows came about around the same time in the mid to late 90s. You know, it's very raw. There's no glitter. There's nothing really fancy about it. And they're both rhythm shows with
super raw
storyline, strong characters. And it's just, it has this accessible vibe, because like Justin said, we're just in like jeans and tees and flannels and boots. And it's got a very working class feel to it. And I think most of the people in this world can relate to that, at least at some point in their lives. They have a point of reference for that.
Yeah. Now, I always sit opening night on the third row right on the end there. So is there a scene where the audience members come up and dance with you? Because I'm happy to do that.
Well,
I didn't think so.
Unfortunately, it's not like the time with Gregory Hines where he'd invite every tap dancer up at the end of the show for a jam.
I love it. You know what I do?
If I could, I would.
I collect a lot of memorabilia, and I just got a pair of Sammy Davis Jr.'s tap shoes.
What?
So, yeah, that's kind of cool, right?
Wow. Yeah. Is that an eBay or somebody
Through somebody tied to his estate, tied to his family. So, yeah, but we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that some other night. But, hey, AJ, I also want to ask you, you did do the Cirque du Soleil. I kind of mocked you for that a little bit up front because of the way you got the gig, which I'm just kidding. But I have to ask you, Cirque du Soleil, I mean, here you're tap dancing, and I know that's what you wanted to do as a professional. What was it about Cirque du Soleil, which, of course, has you flying through the air? I mean, do you see yourself more as that kind of a performer, or are you the no, I'm the Sammy Davis Jr. tapper over here?
I'm more of a tap dancer, like a more musician's dancer. The thing that drew me to Cirque du Soleil, a very good friend of mine, Jared Grimes, was choreographing this Cirque du Soleil show, and he's an incredible tap dancer.
Which Cirque du Soleil?
Pulled me into that show. It was Banana Spiel. We did the Chicago Theater back in like 2010.
Yeah, I remember that.
It's not their greatest claim to fame, but you know, we had about a year-long run. Chicago, New York, and Toronto.
Yeah. And speaking English, because I've interviewed those guys. I did a special with those guys once, and they had to pick certain people because they either had to have translators, or, I mean, so many of them do not speak English. But that worked for you?
Yeah, that was we had, I think, some of the different transplantable acts within Cirque du Soleil. They give a contortion act, you have a high wire act, you have a foot juggler, you have a hat juggler, and they're all from different countries. So sometimes you'll have a cast meeting that includes four translators.
I love it. That's great. Oh, that's kind of what I had to deal with in doing the special. Well, I'm really looking forward to Tap Dogs. This is going to be great fun. I'll be waving to you from down front on opening night. And I want to encourage folks to see it at the Niederlander Theater that used to be the Oriental Theater, now the James Niederlander. You know, you guys are going into a theater that just got renamed for James Niederlander recently.
Awesome.
And you're following Dear Evan Hansen was just there, among other things. So you're going into I don't know if either of you ever performed in the what you would have remembered as the Oriental. Is it a memory for either one of you?
I don't think I performed in this house before, no.
Okay, well, you're about to be very impressed. It's one of the grand old theaters that you can play in. I guarantee you when you get there, you're going to look out at that audience, or you'll step on stage and you're going to go, this is cool. You're going to love it. It's beautiful.
Awesome. I look forward to it.
Yeah, April 16th to the 21st is when you guys are here. BroadwayInChicago.com is where you can get the tickets. And, hey, AJ Russo, Justin Miles, thank you. My dog's name is Miles Batway, so I love saying your name just because it's – and he spells it. He kind of looks at cross between a schnauzer and Toto, which I haven't met you yet, but I don't know if that works there, but I'm just so you know.
Good description.
Yeah, but I have a funny feeling. AJ's probably going to go, you do kind of look like a schnauzer now that I'm looking at you. Guys, anyway.
It's kind of interesting. It's like if we could depict what kind of dog in real life we would all be, that's very interesting. Never thought about that. We should talk about that later.
Well, I've just given you the answer. Now, AJ, you've got to come up with one. So.
All right.
Guys, have a great run in Chicago. Enjoy the city while you're here. Eat some pizza. You can't avoid that. I'll be waving to you. And we're going to go out playing a little more music from Tap Dogs because I want people to get into the rhythm so they can be tapping with you from their seats. Tap Dogs at the Nederlander Theater, April 16th to the 21st. AJ Russo, Justin Miles. Thank you, guys. See you soon. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PAULLISNEK. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.